It is 2:06 on Wednesday afternoon. You're listening to Political Rewind. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. And this is our last show of 2016. We're giving Jim Galloway, who's sitting to my left, he's frowning because he doesn't know we're not on the air Friday, Jim. We're giving the team Friday off, a long New Year's weekend, so everybody can start celebrating early. So this is our final show of the year, and that means that we'll do the New Year's, or the 2016, rather, roundup of big stories, plus a number of other items that are really important in the news right now. I should also point out that we are now about a week and a half away from the start of our three-day-a-week schedule. On Monday, January 9th, which also happens to be the first day of the legislative session, we launch the Monday version of Political Rewind. So we will be on the air starting January 9th on Mondays and Wednesdays at 2. We'll continue at 3 on Fridays. And as I've said before, one of the reasons we keep expanding is that you have told us you like this show and you would like to hear more politics. There are a number of reasons why we think the show is doing a pretty good job presenting politics to you. One of them is the man sitting to my left, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution.
I'll be ready to see this year go. How about you?
Yeah, I think I get that. Jim, of course, has his column in the Thursday and Sunday papers, and he oversees the Political Insider blog, which you can read on AJC.com anytime you choose to. His colleague, Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the AJC, is with us. Greg, nice to see you.
Good to see you, too, and happy Hanukkah.
And to you as well. And Hank Klibanoff is here today. Hank Klibanoff has some of the finest credentials you could ask for in American journalism. He was the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, one of the major American newspapers, the editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and now he does what everyone at a certain point in their careers has to do. He's become a professor at Emory University teaching journalism there. Hank, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to be back with you, Bill. Thank you.
Yeah, we're going to talk a little bit at some point in the show. I want to get your insights, Hank, on the what you think the media relationship with Trump is going to be starting in 2017. But, you know, I think we should start. Greg Bluestein, you gave us the perfect way to start summarizing 2016 political events of the year. Just recently, you published, well, why don't you go ahead and explain the 9 burning political questions of 2016 answered.
Yeah, well, before the year started, me and a former colleague, Daniel Malloy, who is now at Aussie Media, published 9 of the most burning questions of Georgia politics. They were questions like, how will the SEC primary shape the presidential race? Will Georgia lawmakers embrace religious liberty legislation? Are more vast changes to Georgia's transportation network in the works? And 6 more. And we've endeavored to answer them in a year-end column that pretty much says yes, no, yes, yes, no, no.
Well, I guess we're done with that. So let's go ahead and look at some of these questions. And why don't we just start from the top? The question that you and Daniel Malloy asked before the year began was, how will the SEC primary shape the presidential race? And we should remember that Secretary of State Brian Kemp was pushing the SEC primary to get as many southern states together to vote on the same day in the primary as a way to give Georgia and the other southern states more leverage in the election, right?
Yeah, well, back in December, we thought it could be the moment when Hillary Clinton uses that southern firewall to knock out Bernie Sanders. It wasn't the moment she knocked out Bernie Sanders, but it was the moment where she built a huge lead over Bernie Sanders that he was never able to overtake.
And it was also, Kemp had intended this SEC primary to be a reason for presidential candidates to flood into Georgia, and they did. It was not a flood, maybe a nice steady stream.
A stream.
But every single presidential candidate did visit Georgia that week or so before the March 1 primary.
Hillary Clinton did not spend a whole lot of time in Georgia.
She did visit, though, with that Kasim Reed appearance at City Hall.
Right. Yeah. Okay. You know, Hank, that also raises we might as well go ahead and talk about it now. This was also the year, it's not one of the 9 questions that we're going to look at that Greg presented, This is the year that all the predictions were that Georgia was turning purple. Didn't quite turn out that way, did it?
No, and it's been 2 or 3 years we've been hearing that. You know, you remember we went into the last Senate race and the last governor's race, hearing it was a dead heat, that either Nunn or Carter might topple the incumbents, or in Purdue's case, well, it's not an incumbent. And, of course, it didn't really come close. We're not there yet. There are people who are voting who haven't been identified, and I think it's probably an over reliance on polling. I would say that, as opposed to gumshoe reporting. The two guys I'm sitting with are phenomenal reporters. They're out there every day and they're taking soundings. But generally, you know, with the cutbacks in news organizations, there's just not the number of people to send them down to you know, Jessup and to Terrell County and Albany and all these other places and really find out where are their hearts, where are their minds, where is their vote going to go.
But I'll tell you one thing that just to remind is, I think one of the things that the polls missed this year was the issue of intensity. Mm-hmm. And if you recall, I mean, we've seen this before. We just haven't really recognized it. It took Republicans. Mac Mattingly beat Herman Talmadge in 1980. It took them 22 years after that for Republicans to take over the state. And it was largely a matter of voting habits and voting intensity on the other side.
So are you suggesting, and Greg, you can weigh in this too, that although 2016 didn't turn out to be the year that inevitably we're headed to a purple Georgia, if not a blue Georgia?
No, I think we're headed to a more intense Georgia. I think that's what Donald Trump has shown us.
Okay.
Is that Republicans who now rule the South had an opportunity, you know, after the 2012 election to try this expansion of the GOP tent. And of course Trump threw that out the window. And he sided with the people who said, if we can get more and more and more white voters out, then we'll keep our hold off and on the state. And you do that by sharpening your message, by polarizing your message.
Mm-hmm. Hey, even many Republicans see a demographic change coming, but again, like just like Galloway said, they see it in 2024, 2026. They're talking increasingly bold about 2018 chances. I mean, they think that the governor's race, a lot of Republicans, I think, is almost a lock for the GOP in just 2 years. Democrats see a lot of silver linings, though, in this election. It was a 5-point Hillary Clinton defeat, closer than it was in, let's say, Iowa or Ohio, where tens of millions of dollars were spent by Republican by both parties. You know, she did flip core metro Atlanta counties, including Cobb and Gwinnett, both counties that hadn't gone blue in decades. Now, that might be partly because of the polarizing Donald Trump appeal. But Democrats do think that they have, if not a purple state in 2018 or 2020, the beginnings of a purple state, maybe.
The problem is that, of course, 2020 is a census year, and redistricting follows that. And if you don't have either the House, the Senate, or the governor's office in 2018, you're in trouble.
You're locking in gerrymandered districts that keep Republicans really in control, Hank, mm-hmm. for 10 years to come until the next census.
And so many of those cases will make it to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And then it really, that's where...
Which is going to be a heavily Trump-influenced institution now.
Exactly.
And Democrats have, about a third of the state legislative seats right now? Mm-hmm. So they've got a long road to go until they can flip a chamber.
Greg talks about the flipping of Cobb and Gwinnett to Democratic voting counties. Jim Galloway, you and I talked briefly before the show about another part of Metro where things are changing dramatically and rapidly, Henry County of all places.
Right. Henry County went for Clinton, and it had been reliably Republican, but you've seen a huge demographic change. Well, what you saw there, what I found was most interesting, was the election of June Wood as chairman of the Henry County Commission. She is African-American. She is a Republican.
Yeah.
And she was able to build that racial coalition that GOP strategists say is going to be necessary if Republicans are going to be able to hang on long term in Georgia.
But they've been saying that forever. I mean, in all.
Yes, they've been saying it, but it's been so hard for Republicans to reach out to African Americans in any substantial way, and they did that in Henry County.
Do you find it? Do you think that'll spread? Because I just have my doubts that. It's not that African Americans wouldn't be inclined to hear the argument. I'm just not sure that the Republicans are of a mind to make the argument.
There are a couple of special things that went into this formula. Number one is Henry County has got its African American population is professional oriented, very mm-hmm. high income. Mm-hmm. Just remember, Herman Cain lives out that way as well. And so, you know, to me, the path, if you're a Republican trying to reach African Americans, you know, that the path that takes you there is probably through business.
Right. Okay. Greg, let's go to another one. Another one of the 9 burning political questions that you all posed at the beginning of the year was, will Georgia lawmakers embrace religious liberty legislation? This question becomes, again, yes. an important question with the 2017 General Assembly about to meet. But what's the answer to that in 2016?
It was yes, lawmakers are willing to embrace it, but no, Governor Deal was not. And I think the answer for next year might be no and no, but we'll see.
Why do you think that?
I think, and this is just pure conjecture, this is just pure, you know,
conjecture,
yeah, is that I don't think there's any appetite for Republican leaders in both chambers to embrace this year. They've fought that battle. Governor Deal's made it very clear that he's not going to go down that road again. I think you might see other different sort of contentious legislation pop up, but I don't think that it will be in the form of religious liberty.
You've got two things happening. Number one, you've got the North Carolina General Assembly establishing themselves as a poster child for chaos, built entirely out of HB2, which was their religious liberty law.
Yeah, let's remind our listeners who may not have been following it quite as closely. It was the governor, the Republican governor. Governor McCrory, who was adamantly supportive of HB2, and he, you know, it's fairly safe to say, Hank, that played a big part in why he lost to Democrat Roy Cooper in the governor's
race. It was probably one of many issues, and it's, you know, the question is whether he was the best salesman anyway. At the same time, North Carolina worries every progressive in this country. You could almost, you know, it's an ACC state that's almost trying to out SEC the SEC.
All right, but so Jim, you point out that's made many down at the Capitol a little gun-shy about that kind of social engineering.
And then we also have a carrot, because yes. For the first time we have a Republican in the White House, in the U.S. Senate, and the U.S. House, and you've got an initiative by Ted Cruz and Mike Lee out of Utah to have a federal religious liberty law let's be clear, this is all kind of a reaction to the Supreme Court's gay marriage decision. And it's an opportunity for state legislators to say, no, let's take a vacation.
Pass it on. Why not?
Let Congress handle it.
Plus, you have Senator Johnny Isaacson, who has, every time he's been asked about a Georgia religious liberty bill, his answer has been, well, we need to address that in Congress because we need to do something uniform for the entire country.
Well, why isn't that ironic, though? That they want federal legislation on something like that, when all these other issues in which there have been federal mandates, the position has been, no, we need to respect the sovereignty of the states and return that as a state right to the 50 individual states to determine.
Hank, you are right. The emperor has no clothes.
This isn't ideological, it's practical.
Well, Isaacson's counter to that is that free speech should be the domain of federal law. And there shouldn't be a patchwork of states deciding these mm-hmm. issues. But the difference this year is now you're hearing legislative leaders take up that mantle. You heard on the air here a few weeks ago House Speaker David Ralston say exactly that he agrees with Johnny Isaacson. So I think you're going to hear maybe some other legislative leaders and big players, not Josh McCoon and not the chief supporters of it, but others say the same thing, that Congress should deal with this, not the states.
By the way, I don't want to go too far into the show because our senior producer, Jenny Amet, always reminds me I have to do this sooner. please tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Our titan of Twitter, Robert Jimison, is in the control room, and he is always adamant about making sure that we hear from you. I know that Josh McCoon, by the way, who listens to this show with some regularity, did tweet us the last time we talked about a number of the issues that are already on the table. One of them, by the way, McCoon says, don't stop talking about HB2 being the reason McCrory lost. He lost because of toll highways, and that's
there were several reasons. I will agree with him that there were HB2 was the loudest reason, but it was also the reason that Roy Cooper was able to get outside state funding, mm-hmm. which I think was extremely important.
Well, yeah, and the only other thing that we haven't said on this is, of course, in this pitting of adversaries, there is a substantial business community interest that's played out in North Carolina, whether it's the business of the NBA or PayPal or companies like that that are positioning themselves, Delta Airlines here in this state. They're not insignificant players.
And Georgia has eagerly capitalized on that, by the way. Honeywell made it very clear that one of the reasons it did not consider North Carolina but went to Georgia for a big regional headquarters was because of religious liberty bills, and the economic development arm of the state is reminding folks all the time.
And you've got Nathan Deal pointing to the movie industry and attempting to kind of to beef up the music industry in Georgia at the same time. That augurs for no fight over this thing.
There's another question, burning question, that you proposed at the beginning of 2016.
Getting warm in here.
Yeah. that, again, will be a significant question for 2017. Are Georgia leaders really willing to overhaul the education system? Well, the Georgia leadership may have been ready to pass the Opportunity School District to give the state power in taking over failing schools. Voters were not. So your question, Greg, comes back in 2017, and it's right at the governor's doorstep. What are you willing to do for education reform, right?
And that's going to be the big question we look at the beginning of January. And Governor Deal has issued very few specifics about what he's looking to do with education. We know there'll be a plan B for the Opportunity School District that failed. We don't know if he's going to revive his push to overhaul the education funding formula, which was so controversial and that would take up so much political capital. I think he's more likely to push for the plan B and put most of his chips in that basket. But we might also see a more minor overhauling of the school funding
formula. Yeah, that's still going to be hard. I mean, because what you had with the Opportunity School District fight was it turned into a knockdown dragout between the governor's people and your local school boards, mm-hmm. your 180 local school districts, and those are the partners that need to come together to reformulate QBE.
You know, Hank, everybody says that money is not necessarily the answer for failing schools. And I think that's a given. We know there's a lot more needed, but without funding, the other solutions may not be as readily available. And until the governor and his leadership team are willing to propose a dramatic change in how poorer schools are funded in this state, doesn't it create some significant problems in trying to turn poor schools around, failing schools around?
I think they're so far from thinking of that. I mean, if you look at the tuition tax credit bill in this state that's diverted half a billion dollars away from public schools into private schools and some of the top talent from those schools. And I'd go even further and say if you look at some schools that didn't have great football teams that suddenly do have great football teams, you'd find that many of those students went to those schools on these tuition tax credit scholarships as recruited by the schools solely for the purpose of enhancing their football teams. But I think, you know, it's $70 million a year max, I think, and they'd like to make it more. So I don't think that the last 6, 7, 8 years have shown any inclination to put more money into these poor and failing schools. I think there's been an effort to put less into them.
Actually, with Trump's nominee for Secretary of Education, mm-hmm. I'm blanking on the name.
Betsy DeVos.
Thank you very much. I think you're likely to see more of a voucher effort.
She's been a major advocate of vouchers. She pushed him hard in Michigan, and mixed results, Greg Bluestein, as to whether the system that she worked so hard to put in place has had the success that she had certainly hoped for.
And it's an open question, too, to what extent the federal government now pushes school choice, school vouchers, you know, issues that this public's funding public K through 12 systems say undercuts their funding.
All right, before we take our first break, let's deal with one more question on your list. It's an easy one. Greg Bluestein, will Johnny Isaacson host a re-election?
Yes. that was the easiest one of all. The Democratic candidate, Jim Barksdale, proved to be, even though he pumped more than $3 million into his own campaign, proved to be a lackluster candidate. Even fellow Democrats would barely stand with him, and he really never had a coherent message, or he barely got 41% of the vote, so that kind of says it all.
Okay, before we do break, is there any other question in here that you really think we need to address, or Greg's going back to look, he can't remember what they all are. Well, the last one is, and I think we know the answer to this, you asked last year, is there a path for a conservative version of Medicaid expansion? Well, there wasn't.
Well, there will be. And Tom Price is the guy behind it.
Yeah, well, yes. Yes, there will be a federal conservative plan for Medicaid. Block grants is what Tom Price talks about, going to the states, which, Hank Klibanoff, becomes really problematic for many liberals, especially because block grants give state vast leeway in how they distribute that money and inconsistent approaches to how you grant Medicaid.
I'd say aside from that, we did have experience with block grants. We've had it with Nixon. We had it with Reagan. We've had experience with that. I'd actually have to go back and study how that played out in many places to really evaluate it. But the fact is that so many states put so much on the line, including some Republican governors, put something so much on the line with the Affordable Care Act and with expansion of Medicaid. I don't know how they go back. And unless Tom Price can come up with just this seamless, beautiful, harmonic solution, I think there's just going to be chaos and 50 firestorms across this country, at least in the number of firestorms being the number of states that went with expansion.
Well, it'll sure give us plenty of reason to be on the air 3 days a week next year. Jim?
We do know that they've probably put off any end to Obamacare until after the midterms, which I think is significant. I think you're going to see that Price's confirmation hearing is probably going to be perhaps the most contentious.
It'll be contentious. Let's be careful, though, about how we talk about what they're going to do with all this, because we now have pretty clear indication that the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, is going to try to bring an end to Obamacare. He's going to try to push that vote early on. So, it will be essentially kill it and delay the ending of it so Republicans have a chance to try to put something else in place. That creates some significant questions and problems for a lot of people, and we'll certainly have plenty of time to talk about that as we move forward. Mm-hmm. Let's take a break. It's 2:29. You can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. By the way, why don't you tweet to us what you think the burning political questions of 2017 will be? PoliticsGPB. Mr. Lucid tweeted to us, Political Rewind, 3 times a week, and in all caps, excellent. Thank you, Mr. Lucid. You are listening to Political Rewind. It's 2:30. We'll be right back.
Every day, GPB brings you fact-based news coverage, engaging interviews, and smart entertainment you don't find elsewhere. All thanks to listener support. Before 2016 comes to a close, please take a moment to support the listening you do. There's still time to do your part. Please go to gpb.org and click donate to make your tax-deductible year-end gift. And from all of us here at GPB, thank you for your support and happy holidays.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Hank Klibanoff, Emory University journalism professor, former editor of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the AJC. Getting set for that session.
We're already.
Bluestein, are you working out more? Ready?
Yeah, I've been running in the mornings, lifting weights.
And Jim Galloway, the political writer for the AJC, is here. All right, Jim, before we get on with more serious business, you showed me, in fact, we're going to take a picture of it and post it on our website.
Okay, I got to pull it out here.
What was the present you got from your wife for Christmas.
Now, other than that book on how to write a newspaper column.
By the way, if you have not read Galloway's column about this book that his wife gave him about how to write a newspaper column, go to the AJC Political Insider website and
strike a pose.
It was. I needed some vocational training. It's clear. What my wife gave me for Christmas were two buttons, very similar buttons, of a little lapel rooster that says, "I will crow in November," and it has the word Cox on it. It's a vestige of the 1920 presidential campaign of James Cox,
Governor of Ohio,
and the establisher of my newspaper chain. He was beaten in that race by Warren G. Harding,
also an Ohioan,
and a newspaper publisher. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And Cox's running mate that year was a fellow named Franklin Roosevelt.
Yep.
And it was probably the last time the U.S. public saw him walk.
Hmm.
Because right after that election, he contracted polio.
And almost immediately discovered Warm Springs and began coming to Georgia to take the waters here, hoping that they would ease his paralysis. So what a fab. We will, Robert Jimison, our titan of Twitter, why don't you take a picture for us? Or Jenny, you want to get a picture? We'll put it up on Twitter right now. Come on in and do it, Jenny.
Here. Should pass it to Hank. He hasn't seen it yet.
It's really a wonderful little trinket. All right. Let's move on to some more reviews of the year. There's Robert's in the studio right now. Politico this morning published a column that they headlined, "The Worst Political Predictions of 2016. Now, I will say that most of these are not terribly surprising, Hank Klibanoff. They're fairly obvious, but they're worth going over because they give us a chance to look at the year. And as I said in the lead into the show today, I will frankly admit that I was guilty of making some of these mistakes on the air. Number one, Hillary Clinton will be elected president. They attribute that to Frank Luntz, the Republican, conservative pollster and political consultant. But my goodness, I think most of us said the same thing. Greg Bluestein, that election, the surprising ending to the 2016 presidential race, probably one of the most astonishing moments in American political history.
It was. I remember Trump's former campaign manager in Georgia sent me his predictions, and he had Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and I think Minnesota as well, all flipping red. And I put it on the blog as sort of, hey, get a load of this. He was this close to being right, except for Minnesota. I think 95% of at least the political establishment got that one wrong, number one, thinking Clinton would win.
You know, what's interesting to me when I think about that, Jim, is if you listen to Kellyanne Conway talking on any of the shows that she appeared on throughout the last half of the race, of the general election race, she kept talking about the many paths that the Trump campaign had to get to 270. And most people listened to her and said, well, you know, she's good at spinning.
We thought, you know, maybe he had one or two paths, but that was it. And as it turned out, it was Trump who had the many paths, and Clinton who couldn't find the one. I mean, Pennsylvania. I've got to say, Pennsylvania was just a remarkable loss. Wisconsin was even more remarkable. Mm-hmm.
Hank Klibanoff, there will be a viable independent or third party candidate. Bill Kristol. Pushed a third-party independent candidate throughout Trump's rise to the nomination. And there was a thought that perhaps somebody would emerge, but that never developed either. There wasn't momentum.
It's never worked. I mean, up until Ross Perot, I guess George Wallace got the greatest percentage of votes as a third party. I think he got 13%. Perot got in the low 20s, I think.
Yeah, you'd have to go back to the bull moose to see if he got any more than that.
Right. Well, I don't think it. So it's been not a winning formula, you know. I don't think anyone. I think it was wishful hoping and wishful thinking on the part of people when they saw that the way the Republican convention was going.
The one plan that you had from Evan McMullen, a former Republican staffer in Congress,
and CIA agent, was
kind of centered on Utah and winning Utah and maybe a couple other Western states, but he never even took.
Wasn't even close. And then of course you have Michael Bloomberg for a little bit out there as in his projections in the plan that we saw. He had Georgia as one of his targets, kind of splitting the middle between Trump and Clinton on both sides. But, of course, he decided not to run and, I think, endorsed Clinton.
Here's one of the most, I think, astonishing mistakes, errors in that we, I think all of us at one point or another, made during the 2016 race. Politico quotes the Washington Post's a prediction on this, but we all did it. Women will form a firewall for Clinton against Trump. And that did seem what we likely to happen, and it didn't.
No, and I mean, Hillary Clinton, if I'm not mistaken, she lost white women.
Yeah.
That may be the biggest stunner of that race. And, you know, you saw this division between women of my generation and women in Greg's generation, the millennials, they weren't all that excited about an opportunity to crack that ceiling.
And of course, many of the younger voters, women and men, especially in the Democratic primary, flocked towards Bernie Sanders and just weren't enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton.
I was just going to point out that probably no one or the universal prediction would have been going into this past year that news organizations, major news organizations, would continue their downward spiral as far as audience, as far as revenue, as far as interest. And in fact, can you believe it? We're ending 2016 with a lot of major news organizations seeing significant increases in circulation and not-for-profit organizations seeing an increase in donations. It's a good time to be in that business, it seems, again. I don't know how long it lasts. Greg and I were talking before that Washington Post just said it's
60 new hires.
60 new hires. That's 60, not 16, as it may have sounded on the radio. So who would have predicted that?
And that may be one of the kind of silver linings for us as far as the Trump administration goes.
Well, all right, so go ahead.
Job security.
Because we've got a huge confrontation building between that incoming administration and the press.
And we are going to talk about that in our final segment of the show today. But before we get to that, so let me ask you, though, to amplify something. Do we believe, Hank, do you believe, you've had a lot of experience as a newspaper editor, is that a response, the increase in interest in news via newspapers, is it a response to Donald Trump, or is it more generally that this election year was so exciting, so odd, so fascinating, that people just got more interested in the news in general? Or would you probably find that it was the anti-Trump folks who were the bulk of the news subscribers?
You know, fortunately, I don't have to pick one of those over the other. I think it's a bit of both and be completely comfortable
in that. I'll throw a third ingredient in there, and that is just the worry that people have over fake news. A need to find at least one or two or three or four news sources that they can trust no matter what.
Okay, you're leading us to what I really want to cover in the final segment of the show. Fake news, the battles that we're likely to see develop between the Trump administration and the media, and we will get to that. But before we do, let's spend, if we can, just a few minutes. Greg, let me start with you on this remarkable story that developed this week. In the already chilly relationship between President Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu. Netanyahu, they have been at odds almost since Obama first came into office, despite the fact, as the Obama administration points out, they have sent more money and more military hardware to Israel than virtually any administration before them, and yet there is a general perception that Obama is anti-Israel. And all of this led to, of course, this stunning vote by the Security Council last week, a resolution that would condemn Israel for expanding its construction in West Bank communities. Mm-hmm. And typically, the United States would veto that measure. Trump argued publicly that the United States should, and we abstained. And so the measure passed with a 14-0 vote.
And then today we have Secretary of State John Kerry delivering a parting shot, basically criticizing the policy from Benjamin Netanyahu of building settlements on the occupied West Bank territory.
And giving a rationale for the administration's actions.
Well, I'll tell you what. Let's listen. I want to give you all a chance to talk more about this developing story. But right after Kerry gave – let's set it up just a bit. Kerry has wanted, apparently, to give a speech in which he could lay out his thoughts about – the way in which we can finally have a peace negotiation move forward, a two-state solution. They have had no success in moving this forward for a couple of years. President Obama finally gave Kerry permission to go ahead and give this speech as they come to the last 30 or fewer days in their administration. And so he did today. He laid out his proposal for how there could be peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And right after he gave the speech, he gave an interview to NBC's Andrea Mitchell. And let's just listen to a little of Kerry talking about why the United States did not veto that resolution.
Could you possibly be making it worse by making the speech now? Are you pushing Netanyahu into moving to the right because of his own domestic politics?
I think what we're doing is trying to put our experience and the lessons we have learned on the table in as constructive a way as possible in order to get people to stop and think about where this is going. And if we didn't do that, Andrea, if we sat silent, I guarantee you the policy would simply continue, because we've seen it over the last 8 years just continue, even when there's been a conversation about it or an effort to try to move the government in a different direction. So I think that's really, again, the reason the United States voted the way we did in the UN is because it was in keeping with our values of our support in policy for a two-state solution, our support for democracy, our support for an Israel that can be secure. And we don't believe that going towards one state with increased settlers is going to reduce the level of tension and potential violence in the region.
Hank, there's so much we could unpack here. The starting point would be, as we move to 2017 with a Trump administration that says they will stand firmly behind Israel, that is not opposed to the settlements, that's nominated an ambassador to Israel who has said he does not believe in a two-state solution. And increasingly the question becomes, is there still going to be a two-state solution on the table, or is that dead?
Well, I guess it depends on the incoming president and whether he responds impulsively and from the gut, or whether he looks at the long history of diplomacy in that region and comes to a decision and a policy and a position that might be counter to what he has said up until now. The fact is that the now 600,000 people living on the settlements has been a thorn in the side of the U.S. for a long time. And if you had a thought bubble over every single politician's head in Congress right now, all 535 of them, Republicans and Democrats, I think it would be astonishing how many of them are saying quietly that they think that they're glad that Obama took this one for the team, that to position the United States more in favor of a two-state solution. I don't know, I can't speak authoritatively on that, but you've just seen this happen over the last 25 years, and I don't think, it wouldn't surprise me if that were the case.
Well, Jim, Netanyahu's response to this has been to, first of all, accuse the United States of secretly orchestrating this vote, but then to call in the ambassadors to all of the countries that voted for this resolution and to essentially have a temper tantrum about the resolution
and the one
itself.
And the one nation that abstained as well, because the U.S. ambassador was called in too.
Absolutely. Which leads to this notion that while on one hand Israel wants to protect its security in the region, it risks further alienating, being alienated from the rest of the world.
And I mean, at bottom of this is, what will Israel become? Because if you have a one-state solution here, then what is the status of Palestinian residents going to be? What, will they have a vote in an Israeli democracy? One suspects that their civil rights are going to be rather restricted. And that's what the two-state solution has all been all about, going back to Winston Churchill, who was a big advocate of it during World War II.
Well, you know, Greg, the other fascinating aspect of that is demographics are working against the Jewish state of Israel. If it is a one state that we continue to have in Israel, it is going to be dominated by Arabs. There are Arab communities are growing at a faster rate than the Jewish communities are there. So, I mean, Jim's right to wonder, does it remain a democracy if Arabs can start controlling the vote?
And you're right. That's always been the fear of Israelis. I mean, aside from the Orthodox, highly observant community, you know, the more secular Jews tend to have kids at a one or two per family birth rate, whereas Muslims tend to have many, many more children. So the worry for Israelis in the longer term, they'll be outmanned by Palestinians. One of the more striking parts of that speech to me, by the way, was when Netanyahu said friends don't take friends to the UN Security Council. Kerry's answer to that was basically, to paraphrase, saying friends are also not blind to each other. And his quote was, friends need to tell each other the hard truths, and friendships require mutual respect. That's sort of the coda on the Obama Netanyahu relationship there.
I mean, one thing. We'll know which direction I think Mr. Trump is headed in when we have the confirmation hearings for his ambassador to Israel.
Yeah. By the way, none of which addresses the question, and now we're going to have to move on. And none of which addresses the question that the president-elect has decided to undercut the sitting president of the United States in terms of the American position on this. Almost unheard of, Jim.
Right, and it's not just the two-state solution. It's making Jerusalem the recognized U.S. capital.
Yeah. Okay. We got to take a break. It's 2:47 on Wednesday afternoon. When we come back, I do want to talk a bit about Trump and the media and what we think we're going to be looking at as he takes office in just a few weeks. You're listening to Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Carrie Fisher, who has died at the age of 60 after having had a heart attack last week. We'll hear the interview I recorded with her last month after the publication of her memoir, drawing on the journal she kept while making Star Wars. We'll also hear an excerpt of our 1990 interview. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Hank Klibanoff, Jim Galloway, Greg Bluestein are in the studio today for what is our last show of 2016. As I said at the start of the show, we're going to take Friday off, give everybody a long New Year's weekend, and come back here again next Wednesday. And then a week after that, on Monday, January 9th, we begin our three-day-a-week schedule. Edward Funtz tweets us, Norman says, bad news is all the Trump apologists are out of work. Good news is market is booming for Trump explain-ologists. All right. Sam Burnham says, if the Israel deal was so good, why abstain? Why not vote for it? Tweet us at PoliticsGPB. We'll pick some of the tweets to be able to read on the air. Hank Klibanoff, we have this odd, I don't know if odd is the right word, but we've been getting these indications from people like Sean Spicer, who at the time that he made the remarks we're going to talk about was still the RNC's communications guy, but now is going to be the White House communications director and press secretary. And he suggested a couple weeks ago that this daily media briefing, press briefing that the White House is traditionally given, the president is given every day, it's old-fashioned. We may not need it anymore, right?
He has said that, and I think that he's may not foresee the trouble he is going to get in.
Why is that a problem? You know, this is inside. For us, we're kind of outraged by this.
Yeah, I'm not even taking a position necessarily that you have to have a briefing every single day. I think it's if you come up with a new and radical plan without a rationale behind it in front of people whose job is consistently and constantly to ask why, you're going to have to ask, you're going to have to answer that every day of the administration. Why aren't we having a briefing on that? Why didn't we know? And there's nothing worse than not abiding by the no surprise rule with the press. And if the press is constantly saying, why didn't you tell us? Why didn't we know? It's going to be contentious every single day.
Just a note. I mean, being part of the White House press pool is not all that glamorous. I mean,
right.
I've worked with plenty of people who said that once you get past that statement, I'm part of the White House press rule. That's it. But what it is this, these are the people who ferret out the details of what a president is up to. And that daily briefing is the forum where those details come to light. And right now we have a president-elect who doesn't appear to be interested in the details.
And in having anyone interpret what he says or what he does.
Well, that's right.
I had the pleasure and displeasure of covering a governor in Mississippi who, anytime he had a press conference, first of all, he would pack the room with his supporters to try to intimidate the reporters, okay? Mm-hmm. And they would applaud every answer he gave, and they would boo at every question a reporter gave, okay? And after a while, and he was not an articulate man, Cliff Finch. He could not finish a sentence. And we were quoting him verbatim because, you know, actually we start off not quoting verbatim. We were interpreting what he was trying to say, what he meant to say, thinking we're doing him a favor. His press secretary came to us one day, said, stop that, quit interpreting, just quote him. And we said, you don't know what you're asking. He said, yes, I do. And we started quoting him verbatim. And within 3 days, the press secretary was coming back up to the press room saying, we'll take it back. Go ahead and interpret him because no one understands what he's saying.
You know, Greg, well, go ahead. I'll let you talk first.
And for reporters, it's not just the fact that he's not doing a daily press briefing. It's taken in the whole context. The fact that he's railed against reporters at rallies, one rally after another, calling reporters vicious and gutless and cowards
lying
and frauds
media.
And lying. It's the fact that he has talked about loosening libel law. It's the fact that he has not had a press conference and has been communicating via Twitter, which still gets the message out but doesn't go through the media conduit. So there's a lot. There's a number that he has no protective pool. He escaped the reporters early on, right after his election, going to a steakhouse without telling reporters, and which, you know, reporters want to be around the president just in case anything like a 9/11 or, God forbid, anything else like that ever happens. So it's those piling up, which means even the slightest change in seating arrangements or daily press briefings freaks reporters out.
But it's just red meat, isn't it? He's just throwing red meat
right,
out.
Right, right. And I will tell you what, I think long term, I think your review is going to kind of rule. I think what a Trump administration will find out is that a daily press briefing is an opportunity to shape the message of the day.
Right, right.
And if they're not talking to reporters in the White House reporters are going to be talking to other people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're going to shape something.
They're going to shape something.
Well, plus, you know, I think a number of we all may have covered some of the press briefings in the White House. Jim's right. It's not a glamorous job. The briefings are usually very boring. They're very dry, but they establish markers. We get to hear on a day-to-day basis in those briefings where an administration stands on issues that the media wants to ask about or that the White House wants to get out to me. And they establish these markers that you can follow to see the evolution of thinking, the contradictions in policy and thinking. So even if the public thinks this is inside baseball and just reporters maybe whining a little, this sort of, you know, this notion that perhaps the access is going to be limited in the long run, I don't think serves anybody well, including, as you have all pointed out, the administration itself.
Yeah, and almost as important, it also tamps down on the speculation, because even if you have an on-background briefing, you know that when you're asked, we were just talking about Trump's policy on Israel and in the Middle East, and we have no idea what he could be doing. We don't know. We're reading tea leaves here. Those on-background briefings that they give daily give reporters a little bit more grist so they can say, well, it seems like, or, you know, Trump's administration has suggested X, Y, Z.
You know, there's a real important distinction here. We are not any longer talking about the reporters who cover politics. We're talking about the reporters who cover government. And if when the Washington Post says it's adding 60 people, and I promise you there is going to be a greater number of reporters covering government over the next 4 years than there have been. I'm just certain of it because news organizations understand that there is something incredibly fascinating about covering a government that is run by people who hate government. That's an obvious story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to do it every day. Interior would not have been a great department for people to have covered except when Jim Watt was there and was, you know, saying, Interior, I want to sell these public lands. Mm-hmm. I want to privatize the national parks. And if the press isn't there and asking the questions, I think the public gets completely caught by surprise. And if we think Donald Trump doesn't want to rule by surprise, I think we're fooling ourselves. And it is not in the national interest for him to rule by surprise and by impulse.
I think you saw a little bit of that with that tweet about Taiwan that came over, 2 weeks ago? It's 2 weeks old now. It took 3 days for this real story to come out, that this was not just a happenstance tweet, that this was something that had been planned and there was actual policy behind it.
Right.
And I think just the importance of the relationship with China was what drove that 3 day explanation.
Well, another interesting tweet that could have begged for a White House press briefing or some explanation in a formal way, was Trump essentially beginning to talk about expanding the American nuclear arsenal. That's thrown out as a tweet. There's no news conference. We, as Greg points out, haven't had one for months. Were he in the White House at this moment, tweeting something like that, presumably there'd be some mechanism that would allow the press to follow up. But as it is, we hear varying stories from varying spokespeople in the Trump campaign, or now the transition, giving us their own personal take on what Trump had in mind. It leaves us in grave doubt, and it probably makes them vulnerable, as Hank has pointed out, to ongoing speculation about what the heck they're doing.
You got to write something. You're mm-hmm. there. That's your job, is to write, to cover the government. And so, as Jim said, they're going to go somewhere to try to get an explanation for what this is about. And when all you have is a tweet and there's no context, there's no even sense of whether he has any understanding of the history of nuclear disarmament talks.
All right. You get the last word. I'm sorry to say we are totally out of time, but Hank Klibanoff gets the very last word. Greg Bluestein, thank you for being here. Jim Galloway, you know, I love having you here as well. Really interesting discussion, all of you. Come back many times in 2017.
Happy New
Year. Couple quick tweets. Senator Nan Orrick says, enjoying balanced year-end viewpoints. Thank you, Nan Orrick. Josh McCoon, thanks for another year of thoughtful discussion on state, national politics. Thank you, Josh McCoon. Greg Bluestein will be seeing both of you at the Capitol as the session gets underway, and we'll be following the work that you do here, do there. From our team, from senior producer Jenny Ammon, from Robert Jimison, our intern and Twitter titan, we all want to wish you a very, very happy new year and look forward to seeing you back here again. We'll be here next Wednesday, and then we'll be here starting January 9th on Monday for the show. I wanted to go out today with one of the great New Year's romantic ballads, one of the great songs. This is Same Old Lang Syne, and it ends with a remarkable tenor saxophone solo, Old Lang Syne. Thanks for being with us through 2016. I'm Bill Nigut. See you again in just a week.